Namaste. Today, 7th January, has a significance in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, in his journey of yoga, but it goes unnoticed because, you know, Sri Aurobindo is someone who has gathered treasures beyond measure. Otherwise, this day would have been documented as one of the great days celebrated, like we have Buddha's Day of Nirvana, and then we have Mahaprakash Divas for Sikh Gurus, and so on and so forth. Nirvana has been considered as the end point of all yogic journey. Basically, it's an experience where you are done with birth and death and the cycles. That's how it is explained. You have unwoven the web of nature through which the soul moves. It has completed its journey from 1 to 100 through all the snake and ladder game, and now it moves out of manifestation. So it is the much celebrated nirvana we find in yogic literature, and from this experience there has sprung as a kind of philosophy which is known as Mayavad. So the whole idea of Mayavad, which we see propounded mainly by Shankara and many others, is that, well, there is a static silence behind life. There is a state of ineffable peace and silence which points toward the infinite and eternal. And that is ultimately, if we arrive at that, then we have done with birth, done with life, done with death, done with care. So from that state, when we look at this world appears like a misery. We see how the Buddha started his journey. His first premise is this world is dukkham, suffering. And then he gave the Eightfold Path and how we can come out of suffering. And the end point is the silence of nirvana, after which the soul need not enter into this school. So when Sri Aurobindo was asked about this, Sri Aurobindo said, what can I do in my own experience? Nirvana came without as much as asking me, may I come in? And it turned out to be the starting of a whole journey. And it took me into many, many aspects of the beyond, of the infinite. So while he admits Nirvana as a valid experience, he says, I have no objection to those who believe in Mayavad, want to come out or escape from the world existence. But he says, my problem is when you say it is the only truth, and it is the sole truth that everybody, sole path that everybody should take. He says, that's my problem. So this is the day when he had the experience of Nirvana, the realization of Nirvana, because it never left him after that. It went into the background anytime he could enter into it, but it deepened and grew into many-sided splendors of the spirit. So that is the difference. So, having said that, there is a whole background to it. There are many questions connected to it. Today, I thought we'll read the poem Nirvana. But first, just the experience itself. So, Sri Aurobindo was seeking for... He had started conscious yoga in 1904. So, he learnt about pranayama. He was doing 6 to 8 hours a day and had marvelous experiences. Poetry started flowing 200 lines at a time and so on and so forth. And then he was looking for a power that can help him in his work, which was nothing personal, but to secure India's freedom. That was his whole idea. And at that point of time, Barin came to know about one yogi called Vishnu Bhaskar Lele. And he called him. Shubhendu met him at Khasi Rao Jadav's place. And then he took him to the house of Majumdar and Sardar Majumdar. And that's where he had this experience in 3 days' time on 5th, 6th, 7th. This is the background. This is a little bit interesting background about Yogi Lele. Champaklalji knew him even before coming here. So when they were in Patan, they had a small group of people with whom they would guide. There was Dikshit Bhai, who later on came to the ashram, Poonam Chand. And then of course Champaklalji was there, his sister was there. And they used to practice some kind of sadhana, some kind of yoga. And at that point of time, Bhaskar Lele had come. And this is a very interesting story about him, that he saw this girl called Lakshmi, who was Champaklalji's niece. And when he saw her, she said she's a very exceptional girl. And then he asked, why don't you speak something? And this child, probably 12 or 14, I don't remember the age, but she started speaking extraordinary things. So it was one of those things he witnessed, that how the greater power can take hold of a human vessel and make it speak. So he had a very two very strange habits, Yogi Lele. And Champaklalji describes he had blue eyes, bluish eyes, and he had this habit of kind of initiating, not initiating someone, but sometimes he used to eat betel and he would take a piece and give it to the other person. Now, yogis are known to transmit things in various ways. One of them is this, that is the conception of prasad, that you eat what is left over by a yogi and it is supposed to bring something of his consciousness. And we know the mother's soup ceremony where she would take a sip and then pass it on. That whole story we are aware of. And the second thing was, he could never tolerate bad odor. Of course, he was probably seeing things, because odors is one of the ways we can discern what kind of beings are in the environment. That's why smoking cigarette is not a good idea, because apart from other harm to the health, it brings into play adverse forces. And that's why agarbattis, some of them can actually keep away many of these forces. There's a whole science of the subtle senses. So he would keep a handkerchief with him, which was perfumed. And every time there would be an odor, he would, you know. So this is just to know that yogis are of all kinds. And in fact, Sri Aurobindo recounts that later on, much later, he said, Lele didn't believe in transformation of nature. He said, how does it matter once you have realized the nirvana? And there are yogis like that. And the mother says, how Sri Aurobindo took a dig at this whole thing. That, well, you can realize nirvana and yet your nature may remain untransformed. So he speaks about this. Mother, of course, elaborates a lot upon this experience. But then Sri Aurobindo's first experience of yoga before he entered into conscious yoga is when he was 18-year-old, when he had the experience of the self in the mind after reading something from Ishupanishad. And then, of course, 1904, he started this whole journey consciously. And on 5th January, Barinda got Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, and he just told him, sit down, sit quietly and see the thoughts coming from all around, and all that you have to do is to reject them. So Sri Aurobindo says something very interesting in that experience, which I personally find it very interesting. He says, I had no idea that such a thing could happen, but I implicitly obeyed what he had said. See, when Sri Aurobindo speaks about obedience and surrender, because that is how yoga is done. Had he questioned with Lele, how can you say, no, thoughts are generated in the brain? He said, he told me and I sat down. And then he actually started observing, and he saw how thoughts were coming from all around, and he would give them a push and they would start decreasing, gradually vanishing. And in 3 days, he says that his mind was free of all thoughts and his intelligence became free, impersonal and universal. So the intelligence became impersonal and universal. And this is the one of the results. There were other results, like there was the silence of the ineffable. And this whole world started looking like a cinematic picture. After that, he went with Bhaskar Lele to Pune and Bombay and Baroda. Later on, he came back. And then he left the company of Bhaskar Lele. This was his only ever contact with any human guru. People have asked him that, were you initiated in Sri Ramakrishna Ashram or anywhere? He said, no. The only contact he had, contact means what can be called as a guru, was with Yogi Bhaskar Lele. And he told me, sit down and look around, see the thoughts, push them away. And what happened was not something which even Lele had expected. So he, all these thoughts went away, and then he discovered something else also, which he has not given that importance. Subsequently, we see it is that which developed. And because the entire being was cleared of all the clutter that comes from, I mean, Sri Aurobindo's, of course, even thoughts must have been, I fathom, very beautiful when we see his writing. But still, thoughts which are coming from here and there, jostling about in the mind. His vital was already, we can see, he was practicing the yoga of the Gita, the way he lived, the way he conducted himself, very extremely sattvic person who is practicing the yoga of the Gita. And then he asked him one thing, Yogi Lele, because he had to go and give a talk, that Shobindu asked, "My mind is silent, how do I give a talk?" He said, "You just pray to Narayana and give a talk." So he did that and he spoke. He realized, this is so nice, I don't have to prepare anything, I don't have to worry about anything. And then Yogi Bhaskar Lele told him something, because he asked for further guidance. And Yogi Lele told him, "Can you surrender yourself to the divine in your heart?" And Shobindu said, "Yes." He said, "Then you don't need any more guidance." So this is how Shobindu took the first major step. This is known as the first major realization of yoga, in Shobindu's words. For us, even many of his earlier experiences would be as good as major steps. But first major realization, this further universalized itself into the cosmic consciousness, the vision of the one divine everywhere in Alipur jail, and then subsequently the experience or realization of Parabrahman in 1912, and finally the fourth major realization is Sri Krishna completely identifying with Sri Aurobindo. So now coming to Nirvana, Sri Aurobindo was asked later on that how are we to do it? This is a practical question. So he said, "Well, I did it this way, but it's difficult." So he said, "You can call the silence from above. That's an easier way." Mother said something still easier. She said, "Go into the heart center." And she says, automatically everything becomes quiet. You move out of that zone. And of course, if we read Nirvana and the works in the world, in the Gita, Sri Aurobindo describes at great length how the Gita releases us from the stress and strain of this world, from the surface consciousness, and we can arrive at Brahma Nirvana. In fact, Sri Aurobindo says Gita's Nirvana is in a way one step further, because we discover the one divine who is everywhere. And the method we all know is one of the simplest, most powerful, Nishkam Karma, action not done with an eye on the fruit of or the result. This is the most powerful leverage, and action done as an offering to the divine, not to satisfy the ego. Action done later on, the impulse also comes from the divine. Nothing is decided by the human mind that I will do this way and I must do this because it's a work or a mission given to me. Nothing. It all comes as a inspiration from the divine, initiated by the divine, serve Sankalpa Sannyasi. And that is another powerful way to find Nirvana, discover Nirvana, enter into a state of Nirvana. And this Nirvana is consistent with action in the world. Both Sri Aurobindo's life proves that. And of course, often I speak about the picture of Sri Aurobindo in the Surat Congress. One of my favorite pictures as far as the image of Nirvana is concerned. What a yogi in Nirvana would be. We normally think of somebody with closed eyes, with a face which is like Buddha. Of course, incidentally, Sri Aurobindo has spoken about Buddha's face. He said that is the only face, one of the sculptures in India, that's the only face which captures the immobility of the Nirvana in form. But at the same time, he says your face can be anything, and yet you may be in the state of Nirvana. If you take a picture of Yogi Bhaskar Lele, of course, very sharp, intense, piercing eyes. But Nirvana is Nirvana. And the mother says, well, there is a Nirvana, which is a silence behind everything. So there is a physical Nirvana, there is a vital Nirvana, there is a mental Nirvana in terms of the experience. But the Nirvana that Sri Aurobindo is speaking about is when we are definitively established in what is called as the featureless, impersonal Brahman. So that's what he has described as Nirvana. And we'll read this poem, which is written much later. Many of the poems have been written much later, but they describe an experience which took place much earlier. Nirvana. All is abolished but the mute alone. The mind from thought released, the heart from grief, grow inexistent now beyond belief. There is no I, no nature, known, unknown. This city is shadow picture without tone, floats, quivers unreal, forms without relief. Flow is cinema's vacant shapes, like a reef foundering in shoreless gulfs. The world is done. So powerful, as we know. When A review of this poem was published in the newspaper, which we know today as Hindu, the most un-Hindu and deceptive name of the newspaper, I must say. Right from those days. Why I'm saying deceptive? Because it uses the word Hindu. But it furthers everything that has nothing to do with Sanatana Dharma. On the contrary, a very different kind of an ideology. So even those days, someone had published a review. And he said, poems like Nirvana and Transformation is all just imagination, abstractions. And people had the, well, I wouldn't audacity, but at the same time, good, they asked him. And Shobhindu replied, naturally, because for the intellectual mind, all these are abstractions. But what could I do? This is not even a poem which can be called a mystic poem, in the sense it is not carrying a symbol image. It is a real experience. I am describing what I actually experienced. And there are no better words with which I can describe it. And one of the words is, all is abolished, but the mute alone. So it describes that everything was filled by that. He uses the word that. And then he says, you may call it the one reality. Later on it became that one reality, which was filling everything. But it would not speak. You can't go to it and have a question answer dialogue or conversations with God. You can't have it. It is where all questions cease. That's how it's described in that experience of the Purusha in Pursuit of the Unknowable, where you reach there and there are no answer on those lips. There are no questions either. So if you enter there, all questions and questioning cease. So it's understandable why it's an experience so much sought after. The mind from thought release. So it's not only the mind which gets freed from thought, the heart from grief. Because this silence is an all-pervading silence and it takes everything into its fold. It fills the mind, fills the heart. And Shobhindu says that it's when you make the mind empty, then these things automatically, many of these things, states of higher consciousness can flow into you. Now, this is a very interesting aside about Lele. When Shobhindu said, I want yoga for power for action in the world. Then Lele told him something very interesting. He said, because you are a poet, it will come easier to you. It will be easier to you. So Niruddha asked, what has that got to do with poetry? He said, no, it's not that poetry makes sadhana easier, but for action in the world. Why? Because a poet automatically lives in the inner mind, receives from above and expresses outside. So already his consciousness is ready. When such a person through sadhana enters into a state of inner silence or inner quietude also, he becomes a very beautiful instrument for the divine work in the world. That's what he had meant. And we can see that glorious example with Sri Aurobindo. The mind from thought released, the heart from grief, grow inexistent now beyond belief. What a marvelous description. As if it never existed. That is the beauty. You can't even call it back. Oh, I used to feel grief. Where is that? So he's trying to, you can't, it appears as something which never, that's why the impact of this experience makes it appear as if the whole world is unreal. Because all that you experienced at one point of time seems so unreal. It's inexistent now. It doesn't even exist near or far. And the ego vanishes. There is no I. This I is the ego personality. Shobhindu would use the word I, though he seldom uses. That is something very interesting about Shobhindu's writings. Something which had struck me, that except for Secret of the Vedas, very seldom in his Arya works you will see the word I. So when the word I would appear, I would wonder that, what does this I mean? And then I realize it's just a way of communicating. You have to use a word to describe whoever you are. So when Sri Krishna says in the Gita, Aham Tva Pap Sarva Papebhyo Mokshishyami Ma Sucha, it is not Sri Krishna, that little personality, that is speaking. It is a super conscious state, the divine, the supreme Purushottama. But to communicate, he has to use the word I. Because sometimes people say there is no I and they start using all kinds of language. This body which we know as I, so which is of course very pretentious. So spoken about this. I got a marriage card from a friend addressing to Atman and says, Atman so and so is marrying this Atman and please come. So I said, well, I wrote back, you are calling only Atman or physical presence also. So now this is, you don't need that. It's an experience. It's a realization. When it happens after that, it doesn't matter. You have to use some terminology. Of course, Sri Aurobindo speaks about perfection of the outer nature also. But otherwise, it's an experience where this little ego personality vanishes. No nature, not only the ego construct, entire nature, because it's like woven like a thread. It's like a dress. So you have undone the dress, like olden time people could do it with the sweater. They used to, you know, knit the woolen, and when it grew small, they would undo it and make a new woolen sweater for you in India. Okay, so we didn't have those stores where you get ready-made things. It was very fascinating. It teaches us, like at least when I grew up, I said, oh, that is the example of pralaya, how a world is undone. You just have to have the thread, and the information is there in the mind of the one who is going to weave it. So only the form and structure is lost, but not the information of the experience and the, you know, that constituent. So this was my first example of understanding as a youngster what pralaya is. Seeing my mother undo a sweater and re-knit it. There is no I, no nature, known, unknown. This city, a shadow picture without tone. This experience in Bombay as well as in Kolkata. And he says that how he was standing on the terrace and he suddenly looked, the whole city seemed like a cinematic picture. So, no tone. Otherwise, you know, everything, colors and lines, sharpness, they draw us, you know, automatically senses weave, percepts. So, all that vanishes. The city, a shadow picture without tone, floats, quivers, unreal, forms without relief. There is an experience of Swami Vivekananda. It's absolutely very similar when Sri Ramakrishna gave it to him in a different way. So he just touched his heart and he experienced the whole world, because he asked him a question. He had a doubt. Are all these things true? And he just touched his heart and the whole world started quivering, floating and vanished. And he was almost shocked, what has happened? And then he brought him back and he was laughing. Sri Ramakrishna gave the similar experience to his nephew Hirdey, but he lost his mind. And Sri Aurobindo gave this experience to someone else. And that's why he said, you need to have a strong mind even to receive that experience. It's not a negative. He reminds, it's a very, very positive and powerful experience. It's not a negative experience of nirvana. Is not when you feel depressed and empty and you say, I can't have any thoughts, I can't think. That's not nirvana. It's a very powerful, impactful experience, even on the surroundings. As he says, you know, the tiger and the deer lose their strife. It pervades. It's the silence of the eternal. So Sri Aurobindo describes how there was a boy who asked him and he gave him this experience just like that. And he told Sri Aurobindo, I seem to be growing stupid. And Sri Aurobindo, with his characteristic humor, he replies, I told him that's not possible. You can't grow stupid when you already are one. So that's, of course, is fantastic. Way, even with that, he is, you know, characteristic way of responding with that raso vesaha, the ananda. Sri Aurobindo says, this nirvana is a blank experience. It's peace, full of peace. The ananda came much later. He says there was nothing ecstatic about it. Ananda came much later. Ananda is the divine mother. That's how he describes. Peace is the silence of the divine in static poise, the purusha. So when Sri Aurobindo comes, there is peace. When the mother comes, there is ananda. So that's how. That's my simple way to understand. Because ananda is the creative surge. There is a logic behind it. Sat is the divine as purusha. Chit Shakti is the divine as mother. And together, ananda is the surge of creation. That's why all genuine creativity is accompanied by ananda. Whether there is a genuine touch of the divine creating something, or it is just a mental labor, one can feel the ananda in that. by the person who is engaged in it and by those who receive it. So, but here, this is the first experience. So he's describing it. The city floats, quivers unreal, forms without relief. So relief, we know, to create elevations through which you, a whole, in sculpture, in painting, so that the whole picture looks three-dimensional, like a tone. But now it is like on a cinema plate. It is as if all these dimensions are crumbling. It is just like a cinema plate. Flow a cinema's vacant shapes like a reef. How Shivindu is using just those words. Now, you see, reef, he's not used, he could have used like a leaf. Now, reef is, when Shivindu was asked what were you really meaning by it, he said coral reefs. Now, coral reefs are those, little stone-like or rock-like structures with form in the ocean. Generally, they are shallow and they move around. So they move around, and of course they inhabit a lot of life, lives because of that reef. But here it's not about that life. It appears like those rocks which are floating in space, like reefs. Flow a cinema's vacant shapes like a reef, foundering in shoreless gulfs. The world is done. Finished. Your schooling is over. Now, up to us. Whether to a shoreless unknown he goes, or to come back to build a new city of God. So to have a new mind and a new city of God. This is the next step. But here he is describing that experience. Only the illimitable permanent, this is the term which Buddha used, permanent. Shivindu is qualifying as illimitable. So that's where we get the first touch of the infinite. And it reminds me of the only word that Vyas uses for Sri Krishna in Mahabharata to give a hint about his divinity. In Bhagavad Puran, there are many hints. But in Mahabharata, he uses only one place, one word, aprameya. You can't measure him. Literally illimitable. You can't limit him by anything. So that is the sense it conveyed. And it is permanent. Even if the world dissolves, crashes, universe vanishes, still that will remain. So only the illimitable, permanent. So this was one of the words which the so-called critic had an objection to. How can there be anything permanent? How can there be anything illimitable? Quite naturally. Because the person dwelling in limits is trying to understand that which is beyond limits. He should have been told, well, this is beyond your limits. So, only the illimitable permanent is here. Mark the words, is here. It's not somewhere else. When Shubhinda was asked, where is Nirvana located? So he says, it's not a plane of consciousness. It's a state of consciousness. So it's not like there is a plane of Nirvana. But it's a state. It's everywhere. And one can access it through any door. As I said, the mother speaks about these different types, through different doors we can arrive at Nirvana. But of course, it depends on the experience, the meaning we put into the words. The mother describes someone whom she met in Japan and who told him he had achieved Nirvana, and the mother sits, they meditate, and he says, I don't find him anywhere in the Nirvanic consciousness. He could remain conscious in Nirvana. Most will dissolve. And then she ultimately sees that he has stepped out of the surface mind, not even beyond mind, but in some portion of the inner mind. And there is a tremendous peace there. And that itself is taken as Nirvana. So much depends on, we should not go by just the word. But Sri Aurobindo is describing in great detail. Of course, when Buddha says Nirvana, it means something. When Mahavir Vardhaman says Nirvana, it means something. That's an authentic experience. And of course, when Sri Aurobindo speaks of Nirvana, he goes on to describe what is Nirvana. I am not sure if there is any parallel of this kind of a description ever given anywhere. And among the many things for which we owe gratitude to Sri Aurobindo, one of them is this, that he didn't leave these experiences of the ineffable just for our mind to conjure. He made sure that he described it in words which we can at least enter into sympathy with, if not fully understand. So this is so beautiful. Only the illimitable permanent is here, a peace stupendous, featureless, still. So there are no features, you can't describe it, and it is stupendous, very powerful, and there is a stillness. A peace, stupendous, featureless, still, replaces all. What once was I, in it is silent, unnamed, emptiness, content. How beautiful this word is. Content. What a use of the word. Not the contentment of the tamasic man. Are I am content with my everyday meal. This is a powerful content. In one of the Upanishads, we have a description of the one who has realized the Atman. And it speaks of contentment in this way. Tamatmastham yenu pashyanti dhira stesham shantim shashvati netaresham. He who sees that self that has become the many. Tamatmastham yenu pashyanti dhira. Who sees? Who is very patient. You can't get it. Impatience cannot help you arrive at it. And then what happens? Stesham shantim. He acquires peace of the eternal. Shashvati netaresham. Shashvati is the eternal. And again, in another verse, parallel verse, stesham sukham shashvati netaresham. The happiness that is eternal is a peace stupendous, featureless, still, replaces all. What once was I, in it is silent, unnamed, emptiness, content. Either to fade in the unknowable or thrill with the luminous seas of the infinite. That is a state shoreless, in its higher sense directionless, and you wait in that state of supreme contentment because you have done with world and grief and care, and you wait for the next step, either to go beyond and fade into the unknowable or to be thrilled by the luminous seas of the infinite. So who is the luminous seas of the infinite? We see that after the unknowable, pursuit of the unknowable, the next canto is adoration of the Divine Mother. So she comes out of that. So there he stands. He says, all that one can, the senses can weave, all names and forms, even the soul seems to vanish. And as he waits on being's naked edge, that's when he says, one came, infinite and absolute. So that's where we see she came and took the world and soul and nature in embrace. So that is the bliss of the infinite seas, luminous infinite seas, all ripples and powerful, mighty Shakti, infinite ocean of energy, of Shakti, the Divine Mother. He waits for that. And of course we know what happened. The mother came. And when mother came, the emptiness was filled. And actually we see it in Shubhendu's yoga. When someone asked him that you were waiting, he says that could have been true before the mother came. He said it passingly. But actually if you see from 1909, Shubhendu had the Nirvana experience. Then he wrote a few writings. After 1908, he went into the Alipur jail. He had that experience of Vasudevam Sarvamiti. Then he writes few writings in the Karma Yogin. But after that, for a long period, he was having those experiences. But the expression, so he has, he starts, yogic sadhana started, of course, thoughts and aphorisms, some short things like philological studies, he started that work. Most important, Sri Aurobindo Upanishad, very short book, Tantric Siddhi Prakaran. So there are few of them which he writes. But you see, when the Divine Mother comes, suddenly through the Arya, luminous seas of infinity burst forth. This is a very different, one can see the difference, palpable. It's the same Sri Aurobindo, 1913. He had the Nirvana and the Vasudevam Sarvamiti and the Parabrahma realization. And then you see 1914 onwards, what burst forth is something very, very different. I mean, it's the same thing, but that luminous seas of the infinite join. And Shobindo acknowledged that when the mother came, how it changed things for him. And that's what he speaks about it in one of his letters. We'll read that. Now, to reach Nirvana was the first radical result of my own yoga. At one place he says, when Nirodha says, oh, for you, like avatar, it is very easy. For us people, he says, no. I am telling you that it came to me by the grace of the Guru or Krishna and Kali, if you like. He says, it came to me by grace. It was not really effort. Of course, effort is there. There is a background preparation. But more important than effort, it seems, is the way he was living his life. Actually, he was living his life as a karma yogin. And yet it came, he says, it came by grace. And it can be given by grace. The mother, that experience of Amrita and two others, where she says, I can give you the Brahman experience like this, but we are not here for that. Now, to reach Nirvana was the first radical result of my own yoga. It threw me suddenly into a condition above and without thought, unstained by any mental or vital movement. So it's not just the mind which becomes still, the vital, the restless vital, desires, emotions, clutching one very badly. So it changes all that. There was no ego, no real world. Only when one looked through the immobile senses, the senses themselves are drowned in that state of Nirvana. There is no information which is flowing back and forth. Or whatever is coming is being absorbed into that giant knot which is there, luminous knot. And so nothing is really entering. Something perceived or bore upon it sheer silence, a world of empty forms, materialized shadows without true substance. So that's why, just as the materialist is right in saying that, well, this is real. That is not real abstraction. The one who has had the spiritual experience is equally right in saying, this is real. Tadeva brahmantvam viddhi nedam yadidam upasate. This is not real. Your senses are fooling you. And your mind is conspiring in that foolishness. And the vital is playing the donkey. So, from that point of view. But of course, Shobindo brings a beautiful synthesis. This is what he is going to reveal to us. There was no one, or many even, only just absolutely that, with a capital T. Featureless, relationless. He uses the word that very often we see in mystic literature. Tat. Tat tvamasi svetketu. That. So you can't describe it. That's the only way it is used. Sheer, relationless. Sheer. You can't relate with it. It's there. It doesn't care a button about this world. So he says that if that is the final, it is understandable. He says it's not about logic. You can't impose logic on the infinite. But if that is the sole reality, well, then that's how it is. It's featureless, it's relationless, sheer, indescribable, unthinkable, absolute, yet supremely real and solely real. Here, absolute is in the sense of being beyond any possibility of relation, because there is an absolute which is relative to the things in relation. Solely real. This was no mental realization, nor something glimpsed somewhere above. Sri Aurobindo did not ask for it. He did not know what is going to happen. No abstraction. It was positive. The only positive reality. Although not a spatial physical world pervading, occupying, or rather flooding and drowning this semblance of a physical world, leaving no room or space for any reality but itself. Wherever he turned, you know, it was filled with that. Of course, later on, wherever he turned his gaze, he saw the Purushottama behind it all. That he describes in one of his aphorisms. That the Advaitin told me that this is the end. But I pursued my lover beyond Brahman. And I discovered him in infinite personality of Krishna. I cannot say there was anything exhilarating or rapturous in the experience. As it then came to me, the ineffable ananda I had years afterwards. We see that in Savitri, no? That Shubhendu in that state, silence was his sole companion left. Under the arches, dim with infinity, he is moving in that silence, glory of the greatness of the spirit, the spirit's greatness. And then suddenly, a vast descent leaped down. But what it brought was an inexpressible peace, a stupendous silence, an infinity of release and freedom. We know that peace was so powerful that how during the cyclone, mother goes into his room and she sees that the windows are open, Shubhendu is writing on his desk and not a drop of water is entering into it. That is the power of the peace. Till date we can feel it in Shubhendu's room. It's something extraordinary. So that was the power of that peace, which was all powerful. A stupendous silence, an infinity of release and freedom. And people describe that when Shubhendu was in the Alipur jail, the state was as if a nuclear bomb or a bomb had to burst next to him, he would not budge. That was the state. I lived in that nirvana day and night before it began to admit other things into itself or modify itself at all. And the inner heart of experience, a constant memory of it and its power to return, remained until in the end it began to disappear into a greater super consciousness from above. That is how he describes to Barin what I got from Lele, what I experienced in the jail. They were all still touching the hem of the transcendent. He says it was just a beginning. Only Shubhendu can speak like that. But meanwhile, realization added itself to realization and fused itself with this original experience. This is the many-sided synthetic experience of Shubhendu. At an early stage, the aspect of an illusionary world gave place to one in which illusion is only a small surface phenomenon with an immense divine reality behind it and a supreme divine reality above it and an intense divine reality in the heart of everything that had seemed at first only a cinematic shape or shadow. So this experience is described in other poems also, where the experience has grown and that which appeared like a blank started getting filled by the one divine reality. And this was no re-imprisonment in the senses. What a meticulous way Shubhendu describes. It doesn't mean that now I am back to the senses and looking at the world and one. No diminution or fall from supreme experience. It came rather as a constant heightening and widening of the truth. It was the spirit that saw objects, not the senses. When Dr. Manilal in one of these places asks Shubhendu, that how do you actually see us? He says, I actually see Brahman assuming the form of Manilal and coming to Brahman, which is here in Shubhendu. And see his poem, he speaks about the spirit, how there is a simultaneous experience in that poem on the cat, where he speaks of the fur-footed Brahman or the four-footed Brahman, doesn't matter, whichever way. Fur-footed Brahman. Whether she is a woman, a spirit, or a cat, this is the mystery I am wondering at. So at once he sees the form, he sees the spirit, the all-pervading Brahman, and he also sees the entire evolutionary curve. She is going to become a woman in maybe, you know, a life or couple of lives beyond. It's a marvel. The freedom in infinity remained always with the world or all worlds only as a continuous incident in the timeless eternity of the divine. So in that, whichever world one was in, there was a continuity of that experience. This nirvana is not a world, but it's an all-pervading reality which is there behind every world. And then he says, Now, that is the whole trouble in my approach to Mayavad. Nirvana in my liberated consciousness turned out to be the beginning of my realization, a first step towards the complete thing. Not the sole true attainment possible or even a culminating finale. So it was neither the sole attainment nor even like, okay, there are many attainments, then it ends in Nirvana. It came unasked, unsought for, though quite welcome. Sri Aurobindo has his sense of humor so intact everywhere. I had no least idea about it. Even Lele had no idea about it. And after some time he said, I can't understand what is happening. In fact, no aspiration towards it. In fact, my aspiration was toward just the opposite. Spiritual power to help the world and do my work in it. Such a beautiful reminder to us. Seek Nirvana for the coming out of your tangle of works, and Nirvana will elude. Seek to do divine work in the world and Nirvana will just come. He will send, please serve to you on a plate. Who has sent you? The divine has sent. Why? I didn't ask for it. Because you have to do works in the world. You cannot do it unless you have gone beyond the heart's griefs and sorrows and the mind's thought process and the traffic jam that happens in the mind. Just the opposite, spiritual power to help the world and do my work in it. Yet it came without even a, may I come in, or a, by your leave. That's how it came. It just happened and settled in as if for all eternity, or as if it had been really there always. And then it slowly grew into something not less, but greater than its first self. So that we know that it grew into that Vasudevam Sarvamiti, that one illimitable permanent, then the divine presence in everything, and then of course the Parbrahman and many other realizations. How then could I accept Mayavad or persuade myself to pit against the truth imposed on me from above the logic of Shankara? So this is how few questions that are related to it are, can Nirvana, does it require withdrawal from the world? Sri Aurobindo says no. Categorically, whenever this question was asked, and he cites the example of Gita and his own example. He says, good Lord, my whole life then is meaningless. He says, Sachidanand. That's what he ultimately went on. And he says, you can realize it while being not only engaged in work, but works of a ghore kind. He says, I have done the politics of the most dangerous kind. And of course, Sri Krishna's example is there. So it doesn't require withdrawal into some monastery, into sannyas. But what is important is inner tyag, the rejection of desire, the rejection of the ego, to tell it to keep quiet and sit in its place, the aspiration toward the eternal. And the more selfless we become, the more there is a chance of Nirvana coming in as a gift of grace from the divine. Second is, of course, people ask that Sri Aurobindo said, my yoga begins where other yogas end. So freedom from ignorance is what is called as moksha, because a parallel term used for Nirvana is moksha. And this celebrated moksha is everywhere. The last you will see is Mukti Dham, when after death you say ultimately. Now this is how these great profound terms get so limited and distortion. Moksha is not about death. Moksha is a freedom we discover while in the body. Then only it is moksha. After death, you are in another groove driven by this or that entity. We don't know, depending on how one has lived one life, and comes back. So death is not moksha. But while living in the body, one can arrive at the freedom from ignorance, and that is what is moksha. This is the first step, as we see in Savitri, freedom from ignorance. That is the first step. And what is meant by that, Sri Aurobindo says, is minimum to discover one's own soul. Then one knows that one is not this nature. Nature doesn't change with that. And yet, one knows that I am not this. And this knowledge is not intellectual, but something like a settled fact in oneself. It is accompanied by a sense of immortality. It is accompanied by many things. One of them is fear of death completely vanishes, because you know that there is this immortal self. Many things break away. The barriers in which we live in a certain identities formed by birth, all these automatically vanish. So in yoga, when it is said that it begins where other yogas end, and of course not every yoga ends even with moksha. Most yogas enter into some subliminal territory, has some unusual experiences, and people believe that this is yoga. But that is simply rending the veil a little between the surface consciousness and the inner. So the inner consciousness is vaster. The inner mind has access to thoughts which are beyond, not accessible to the surface mind. The inner heart has access to what's going on in connected hearts. This is the way it widens into cosmic consciousness. One of the ways that one gets liberated in this yoga is through widening of the consciousness right into cosmic consciousness. But this is one of the ways that one enters into the inner territory, even inner physical. So we can, the inner physical can extend and register events which are in the subtle physical before they have actually happened. So it extends and comes. And the outer mind then later on, either in dream or in thoughts, they come in some way or the other. And of course, when one is in the state of inner freedom, as Shubhendu says, the entire Arya was written in that state. Thoughts come as inspiration, luminous inspirations, intuitions, revelations. They arrange themselves, the sequence, the logic, everything comes. And he says it's not that one has to use logic. But he says that in Arya I was using the overmind view of things, so even the logic is arranged. It's not that one has to try to link bridges, connect. It all comes in one pack, entire thing. But he says in ordinary life also, when these intuitions come, they have to wear the official garb. So we tend to discard it. We don't accept it. And sometimes they have to come through, they have to wear the dress of an analytical reason. And very often they are digested, chewed. And then he says that sometimes in this chewed up material, you will see a little bit of that intuition shining and saying, sir, don't stomach me in. I am there. Hold it. But it's surrounded with so much of analysis and much of scholarly work. And of course, intuition itself is rare. But if the mind is quiet, the entire seas of rivers of inspiration and intuition and revelations, as the Vedic rishis say, they pour in. Of course, for sure, Bindu, it is seas of infinite ananda. So I'll close with this last line. And then it slowly grew into something not less but greater than its first self. How then could I accept mayavad or persuade myself to pit against the truth on me from above the logic of Shankara? And finally, to close, because people often ask how to silence the mind. The moment they read Sri Aurobindo's writing, first thing, silence the mind. They try so many things. Of course, witnessing oneself. There are plenty of practices. But they forget that Sri Aurobindo's experience came to him, well, in a harder way, if I may say so. But to us, it can come in a much simpler way. And that is the grace of the Divine Mother. Because she is both beyond the nirgun and the sagun, beyond being and non-being, beyond manifest and unmanifest. And it's her grace that she has assumed a human form and a name. And all that seems so difficult, near impossible to the human consciousness can come simply by grace. That's what she writes in her prayer. I think 28 December, there is a power no ruler can command. And in that, one of them is, there is a peace that one finds nowhere, not even in death. And then she says that power, that knowledge, that love, that peace one finds by the divine grace, in the divine grace. The divine grace can give all this to us. And when the divine grace comes, it gives not only the peace of nirvana, but many more things, because she is the Divine Mother. Namaste.